The people who are perpetrating violence, the one who has abused me, the one who has raped me, is walking around free. I'm the one that's suffering.
Matt Brown, author, speaker, and co-founder of the social justice movement, She Is Not Your Rehab. A survivor of family violence and childhood sexual abuse himself, Matt began his advocacy work by sharing his story with the men who frequented his barbershops as a way to foster vulnerability, healing, and connection.
Forgiveness is one of the key factors to healing. I hated the word, the term forgiveness, until my son was born. I held him in my arms and I thought, how could anyone ever want to hurt something so precious, so innocent? My son was my invitation to forgive. And when I think of forgiveness, I think of letting go. Because me holding the anger would turn into resentment, bitterness, that would just then transmit onto my dear child who was innocent. And I think healing is not a destination, it's a journey.
This is the Fresh Money Podcast.
74% of Pacifica, 56% of Māori feel unconfident or unsure when making financial decisions. This podcast is all about opening up the conversation of money and to help everyone get better at it. So if you can please like and subscribe, it's our promise to interview more people who can help and inspire you to become better with money. Please note that this podcast does not constitute financial advice. If you are needing financial advice, please consult a professional or get in touch and we can point you in the right direction.
Welcome to the Fresh Money Podcast, where we open up a conversation about the normally taboo subject of money. From personal finance, business to investment involves money. We'll be talking about it. And I'm extremely honoured to have on the show today Matt Brown. Matt.
My little lover.
Welcome. It's a real honour and pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me, Els.
Cool. Why don't we start with, if you could please introduce yourself, and for the one or two people who don't know what it is you do.
Tātou whālawa, my name, Oro Ingo, or Taimalangi Mate o Whawhitei Maliko Brown. I was born up in South Auckland, Mangere. But raised down here in Christchurch, or Te Tahi. My parents hail from the beautiful island of Samoa, Sapapali I Falakei. But yeah, I'll consider myself a Cantabrian, a Crusader supporter. Most people couldn't pronounce my name growing up on this side of Aotearoa, of Christchurch. So Matt or Mateo, I'm known as. That's pretty much me. And yeah, come from a big line of a family of five boys and four girls.
Cool.
This work, I work in the mental health family violence prevention. I do this work with my wife. We started a kaupapa, a movement called She Is Not Your Rehab.
Cool.
And wrote a book, which became a bestseller. And now we just travel the world talking about, mental health and how to help our communities do better, heal, especially our fathers.
How long has She Is Not Your Rehab been around?
She Is Not Your Rehab was birthed during my TED Talk. I think I did my TED Talk in 2019. So about 5 years ago. I got asked to do a TED Talk. I had never heard of the TED platform. They approached me. I thought to myself, what does this brown boy, what can I have to offer? Because I jumped on YouTube and I seen all the TED Talks. They were researchers, scientists, like academics. I'm like, man, I'm just a brown boy from the hood cutting hair. But I married a really, really strong Māori woman, Wahine, who Sarah, from Ngāpuhi, Te Rārawa, who said, get your ass out there and tell your story.
Yeah.
And so I did. I did that TED Talk. And that was the launch of our movement, She Is Not Your Rehab.
And kind of speaking, I've seen the video. It's epic. You're speaking in quite a big crowd. What gives you the confidence to kind of address that type of crowd?
Man, I mean, I suppose growing up in church helped that. White Sunday school, where you have to memorize your Bible verses in front of you, and if you get it wrong, you get a flying gender.
Yes, you get a tricky review.
Hard out, exactly. So I think just growing up, I was conditioned to speak publicly.
Cool.
What people don't know is I hate speaking publicly. I get real nervous. I'm a real introvert, so I'm not really – I'm an awkward turtle when it comes to being a social bunny.
Yeah.
I think even doing that talk, what launched our movement, I was so nervous. There's so many stories, obviously, to share, but I thought, what can I share that will resonate with, our community? And so the TED Talk is a very watered-down version of my story. But I suppose I use the Christmas story in there because everyone, you know, in the Western world, we celebrate Christmas. And that was my first, I suppose, experience of family violence. And that just connected with a lot of people because, you know, a lot of whānau families struggle with Christmas. You know, it's not a happy season as it's promoted online. It's quite a hard, tough holiday season.
Yeah, so they're definitely connected because of, you know, over 158,000 views, which is epic.
Thank you.
What does She Is Not Your Rehab mean?
Great question. Look, when we launched that movement, that slogan, there was a lot of pushback online, especially from my brothers, from men in general. Being a barber myself, you know, talking to men daily, you know, we got comments like, oh, he is not your rehab too, which we know, like, you know, anything can be your rehab center. It could be your gym, KFC for some people, myself, you know, whatever we use to rehabilitate ourselves.
Yeah.
But for me, it was my personal story of witnessing my dear mum, my beloved mother, be a rehab center for my father, my entire childhood, like witnessing my mum rescue, taken back. And I was the kid who was always holding mum's hand to the next woman's refuge home, like wondering if the next hiding was going to be her last hiding. And so I just had enough. Mm-hmm. It was like too many of our sisters were just, you know, going through refuge, were being murdered. Like currently right now in Australia, we've lost over 20 women to family intimate partner violence. And we're only in April. So we've lost more than one woman a week in Australia. In New Zealand, we sit right at the top of the OECD world when it comes to our family violence statistics. And so the slogan wasn't to shame or humiliate men. It was our invitation to our brothers to take responsibility for our pain, our trauma, that your childhood trauma is not your fault, but your healing is your responsibility. Because what we don't transform, we will transmit onto our most vulnerable, our children.
Yo.
So that's
awesome. Thank you. That's awesome. And you do this mahi with your whānau?
Yes, right? It's a family kaupapa. Cool. My kids are born into the kaupapa. When you ask my kids, what does mum and dad do for work? Yeah. Their response would be, all they do is talk about trauma. But for us, it's a purpose. It's, you know, it's not a job. Like to wake up in the morning and read another headline news that another woman has died or another brother has taken his own life to suicide.
Yeah.
Like that's I personalize that because I've lost a lot of close friends to suicide, and I've lost, you know, watching my mum live in family violence, hearing sisters live in family violence. Like, it's not just a job, it's a purpose.
Yeah.
So
May. Awesome. We're definitely going to come back to that.
Thank you, sir.
But I just want to dive into your early years, really. Growing up in a family, where are your parents from?
My parents are from Samoa. The villages of Falilakei and Sapapali'i. So mum and dad moved over here in the 50s and 60s. They actually met here in Tamaki Makaurau up in Auckland.
Okay.
I think at a siva, at a social, you know, church gathering. And they became friends and fell in love and had us, really. And my dad did a long leg in prison for stuff I won't talk about.
Yeah.
But when he was released, he got shipped down here to Christchurch. He got offered a job down here, and the company that hired him offered, you know, to pay for all of us to move down to Christchurch. And so my father wanted to get us away from the South Auckland environment. So we came down here, but my older siblings brought that environment down with them. Violence, gang culture, drugs was a normal part of our upbringing, mixed in with church and religion. And so Sunday, we would put on our best clothes, but Monday to Saturday was Once We Were Warriors. So that's my story in a nutshell.
That would have been quite confusing, right?
So confusing.
On Sunday, you're one thing. Monday is a switch and it's totally different.
100%. Especially growing up in the Western culture, like at home, mum and dad, you know, their word is final. But then you're at school in the Western system where you're taught to think for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But at home, we're not taught to think for ourselves. Mm-hmm. You have to serve. It's all about, you know, the family, the church, but then at school you're taught to totally think something else. And so it was conflicting, but it's what makes all of us, you know, as islanders who are born here.
Yeah, crazy. My wife and I, we spent some time in Samoa a year just doing some volunteer work, and a lot of Samoans we talk to, their whole goal is to get off island. To go to Australia or New Zealand to the land flowing with milk and honey. What would it have been like for your parents coming here to New Zealand, going, "Hey, this is going to be, it's going to be great for us." Like, and then, yeah, what was their experience, and were they surprised by?
I think it was hard. Like, my parents couldn't speak English, you know, and so that factor, you know, that was a almost. It was hard for my dad, you know, especially experiencing the dawn raids. You know, they lived through that season in Aotearoa. And so, you know, you got to think, you can't speak a language. You're working in a factory job. You're humiliated for being brown, for being islander. You're helping build this country. Like, the shame that sat with my dear father, you know, it must have been massive. And so because you're not taught, and there's no tools back then in the 60s, 70s, how to regulate yourself. Regulation was then on, I suppose how he regulated himself was finding alcohol. And then that alcohol turned into anger, that anger turned into violence, and that was transmitted onto us kids. And so a lot of the hard work that we do, my wife and I do, is to really teach and educate, you know, men in particular, because this movement started in a barbershop, which was predominantly, you know, men that were coming into for haircuts. Our whole goal was to educate men how to regulate themselves, you know, and don't transmit their pain onto our children. And so I just think, my dad, it would have been hard for my mum and dad. And so I don't hold anger or resentment to my parents. You know, they did the best with what they had, with what they knew, with the tools that were available to them, accessible to them. And so, but it doesn't condone, you know, that's the abuse that we suffered and endured, but it releases me to be the father I am today to my children.
So obviously financial stuff was big stress at that time.
100%. I mean, all our money went to church, you know, and that's not to, you know, to knock it or anything, but it was, you know, we have this rooted belief system in Pasifika culture, especially in our religion and our faith. It's all about the church. It's all about, it's church. When we say church, you know, it's God, but I say church, then it's family, and then it's, you know, your village, your community. And so, I mean, it was hard, you know, growing up in a Western culture where you're taught to think for yourself and ask questions, but we're at home, you're not allowed to ask questions, you know. So, "Mom, why is all our money going to the church?" Yeah, we're living on bread and rice, you know. And then all my kids at school are having these flash lunches, and where we have these, you know, spaghetti on sandwiches or tuna on sandwiches, you know. But I mean, today I love that, you know. tuna sandwiches is mean, but, you know, as a kid, like, I wanted the least snacks.
The roll-ups.
Chris,
what are your thoughts about that in terms to like tithing and giving to the church? You know, I counsel a lot of Pasifika through that. What are your thoughts on
that? You're going to get me cancelled. My thoughts on tithing, look, I think tithing is an old school covenant. I think it's beautiful when we can. I think that the purpose of tithing is to teach community living, you know, if the money does go towards the community. But what I'm seeing a lot today, and it's been, I suppose, magnified due to social media, is a lot of churches are not using it for the community. It's going to their pockets. It's going to build their empire, but not really the people. And so I struggle when people give and it's not reciprocated back to people who are vulnerable, who are struggling, you know. It's fine that we build these bigger buildings, but we don't need 10 TVs in a building. We don't need, you know, the best sound system in a building. Like, love is to serve. And so that I find problematic with tithing, if it's not going back into the people.
So growing up in that, you know, kind of chaotic environment, your mum and dad are both at each other, at you guys, how did you, or when did the healing begin for you?
I left home at 15. So, you know, this the work that we do comes from a real place. It's my lived experience of struggling with depression, struggling with suicide ideation. And the reason why I left home at 15, I actually talked about my story of family violence and being sexually abused at high school. You know, at school, we were tasked to do a 3-minute speech in English. I decided to courageously, either it was courage or stupidity. I stood in front of my peers in my English class and talked about family violence experiencing.
What made you do that?
Because it was either speak up or take my own life. And so I had found myself many times at the train tracks, you know, hoping a train will come and free me. So suicide was a constant companion of mine right throughout my high school years. And so I decided to speak up about it. And then I just decided I can't do this. Like, either I take my own life or I leave home. Because home was chaotic. Like, Jake the Musk, when we talk about Once We Warriors, yeah. I mean, we think of that movie, that, you know, New Zealand cult film, Once We Warriors, like, we would compare Befeke's black eyes to my mum's black eyes. Like, nothing. Like, not even comparison. Like, me and my brothers will joke about it. Mum's black eyes are way bigger than Bef's. Why? Because mum will go to church like this. Bruised face, wearing her big sunglasses to hide her eyes, yet no one ever said or did anything. People knew the violence, people heard the violence, people witnessed the violence, but no one ever spoke up. And so I just said, now I had enough. And I remember telling my mum that I was leaving home at 15. And my dear mother, bless her soul, she held a machete to my neck. And she said, if you leave, that's it. And I said, well, either you do it, mum, or I'm doing it. And I walked out with one bag. And that was the beginning of my healing journey. And as tough as it was, like the shame and the ridicule I got from my peers, especially the Pasifika community, was massive.
Wow.
Like, how disrespectful you are to your parents, you're dishonoring our culture, like all the names that under the sun of this brown boy, you know, rebelling or just leaving home because home was unsafe, I was labeled.
Yeah.
But that was the beginning of my journey. So 15, I'm now 38. And I think healing is not a destination, it's a journey.
Yeah.
I'm still on that journey. Yeah. Hard, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. What place does forgiveness play in your healing? Well, anyone's healing?
Everything. I think forgiveness is one of the key factors to healing. I hated the term forgiveness growing up, especially in church. It was thrown around like it was, you know, breakfast.
Yeah.
Forgive, forgive, forgive. But I'm like, we forgive, but the people who are perpetrating violence, the one who has abused me, the one who has raped me, is walking around free. I hated the term forgiveness until my son was born. I had my son Angelo. When this little thing came out of his mum, I held him in my arms and I thought, how could anyone ever want to hurt something so precious, so innocent? Mm-hmm. And so it was then, my son was my invitation to forgive. And when I think of forgiveness, I think of letting go. Because me holding the anger would turn into resentment, bitterness, that would just then transmit onto my dear child who was innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew if I had to be the father that I never had, or the father that I never witnessed, or the husband I never witnessed, I had to let go. So forgiveness to me is letting go.
Yeah.
It doesn't condone the behavior, the bad behavior, but it releases me to be the father I never had.
Yeah, absolutely. So is that, because a lot of people have, like you said, the term forgiveness is thrown around in church. Is that part of your definition?
Yeah, that's my definition, is letting go.
Yep.
Forgiveness, because holding anger is just, it's a poison. You know, drinking poison is not good for anyone. Like, the people who perpetrated violence on me are sleeping fine. Like, I don't know what's going through their head, but I'm the one that's suffering.
Yeah.
So I had to release that.
Bar it out. And when did my father's barber begin?
My father's barber started early 2010.
Yeah.
I started in my little garden tin shed in a place called Aranui, which is on the east side of Christchurch. I just picked up some Remington clippers. I couldn't afford to go to barbering school, watched some YouTube videos and then thought, I can do this. little did I know, you know, these Remington clippers on the box that say titanium blades, but that touch Polynesian hair, it's blunt. But I started with what I had, you know. Yep. I started in this little garden tin shed. You know, it was the boys in the neighborhood coming for haircuts, $5 haircuts, you know, pushed my prices up to 10.
Yep.
And then I found myself booked out. Like, I was cutting from 6 a.m. to midnight, most nights, 6 days a week. My mum refused to, you know, she said, if I find out you're working on Sunday, you're in trouble. And so, yeah, that's where my father's barber started from, in Aranui, in a little garden tin shed. And it just grew. Just grew. Like, if you told this brown kid that one day I would have the busiest barbershop in Aotearoa, one of the busiest barbershops in Australasia, I would never believe you.
That's crazy.
I would never believe you.
Why does it resonate with so many men?
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I got into the barbering industry, at first I loved the element of cutting hair, and, you know, because hip hop was really one of my saving graces. Watching fashion, watching these rappers have dope hairstyles on TV, you know, black men and black women across the world, they would never ever know my story or our story, but it was through their lyrics that really resonated, connected with this brown kid struggling, you know. And so I fell in love with barbering through hip hop. It was through the art of storytelling. And I think when men would sit in my chair and trust me with their hair, with their outer appearance, they soon started to trust me with their inside stories that they had kept, that not even their partners knew about. And so I found when I was vulnerable with my story, when I would share my story, it gave them permission to share their stories. And really that was how our business, our Kaupapa, really grew, was just through vulnerability conversations. Crazy. Vulnerable conversations.
Crazy. And in terms of finance, like starting your business, and how did you stay on top of those? Like, was it just learn by experience or?
You know what? I will say one of the best investments in my life, in my career, in my personal life, was marrying my best friend.
Yeah.
Was my wife, Sarah.
Cool.
My wife is a marketing guru. I actually met her. She used to work for a non-for-profit organization fighting human trafficking. And so I was attracted to this strong wahine who knew who she was, who was so boundaried. Growing up in my household, we didn't not know anything about boundaries. There was no boundaries. But I was really attracted to this woman who had just had so much passion and zeal for life, had so much integrity. We were friends for 4 years. She moved over to the Cook Islands and we would talk on the phone every day. And she decided, she was there for a year with her daughter, our daughter Oceana.
Mm.
When she came back, she decided to come back to Aotearoa, and I said, why don't you come and help me in my little garden since she barbershop? Yeah. I want to grow this into a bigger business. And she said, okay, I'll give you 1 year. So she came for the year. And by the end of that year, I asked her to be my girlfriend. I asked her to be my girlfriend. I fell in love with her.
Yeah, awesome.
But in that 1 year while she was here, she utilized her skill set to help our business grow.
Yeah.
And so she had this idea, how about you start teaching? Because I had my unique skill set was doing hair art. So I was doing portraits of, you know, celebrities, artists, and people's heads. So kids would come into the barbershop. That's how I was booked out. No one was doing hair art. No one was doing all these fancy lines in New Zealand, really, or in Christchurch. And so she utilized her skill set and catapulted our barbering tutorials. So no one in Australasia was teaching barbering.
Mm.
So we put it up on social media, utilized the power of social media, Facebook. I was doing classes in Auckland and Wellington and Christchurch. They sold out within a minute.
Yeah.
And so that was really like, oh, there's something here. Like people want to learn. And then she decided, if you want this barbershop, your flagship shop, then we need to make more money. And so she had this idea, let's do a tour in Australia. And so we did. We did 9 cities in Australia, 20-something classes.
Sheesh.
22 or 21, I can't remember. And all the classes were sold out. And so we came back with, you know, thousands of dollars. And we opened up our main barbershop in Christchurch. And I think I got the respect from my neighborhood because they knew where I came from, you know.
Yeah,
mate. I had their story, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, created our business legit. It wasn't through hustling, drug dealing.
Yeah.
Like we worked hard for it.
Because I think you can, obviously, you know, the guys around you, are credited of kind of lifting up the barbering industry in New Zealand, from what I know, because, you know, I see them popping up, not everywhere, but there's way more than what they used to be.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Is that from that work that you guys put in there?
I believe so. Mm. There wasn't many, if anything, like all the urban barbers were just cutting from home, you know, so I think I was one of the first barbers who kind of jumped and just, you know, put all my, you know, what I had into our business. There was no one really doing it on social media.
Yeah.
I was one of the first, you know, in New Zealand, in Australasia to put haircuts up online. Like they went viral. My haircut of Tupac that I did, a portrait of Tupac, which really set the stage for me internationally was it went viral. Like the Tupac official page in America shared it. They had over 1 million likes and shares. And so, yeah, I think Polynesian barbers, I think kids, it gave hope to young brown kids who came from similar backgrounds, like, oh, if he can do it, I can do it too. And that was the whole goal, was to really inspire other kids, like, you can do this, you know, we can do this as a people.
Right. What does it take to run a barber?
Oh, to run a good barber shop,
yeah,
I think you need to have a good barber leading. You know, I know there's a lot of people out there who on the business side of barbering, you know, who just create these barber shops and get barbers in. But unless you're a barber yourself, I don't think you'll have a successful barber shop. Most of the successful barber shops out there are run by good barbers, because you want to model and lead by example. You know, barbering is all about service. And so if you're the top person is not modeling what service looks like, what humility looks like, then you're not going to get their flow on effect from the rest of the staff. But also financial literacy is important. A lot of barbers, I'm going to speak for barbers only, but I suppose it's general in most workplaces. As soon as you get your paycheck, you want to go, you know, splash that on the latest Jordans. Yeah. and so we were very intentional with our barbershop.
Yes.
We had to teach our barbers financial literacy, saving their dollars, nice. You know, every haircut. I would teach barbers to try and save $5 for every haircut. You know, if you're doing 20 haircuts a day, you know, that's $100 a day. If you're working 6 days a week, that's $600. And just teaching financial literacy, you know, setting goals. If you wanted if it's a house that you want, if it's a car that you want, find out the price and then let's work our way back.
Yeah.
You know, so for a lot of my barbers, this was like new. Saving money was never a thing.
Oh, shit. What else would you tell, you know, and I still see, you know, barbers popping up here and there. What advice would you give to them, you know, being someone who's started and because you opened up other shops as well?
Yeah.
What advice would you
give? Find your niche. Like my niche was hair art at first, because no one else was doing. People thought that's all I did. But so mums would bring in their kids to do these, you know, their team sport logos on their head or a line or a lightning bolt, whatever it was. And then they will, you know, find out, oh, you do normal haircuts too. But that's all I pushed online was just hair art. I was just doing portraits and that would get our audience. And, and then after that, everyone else started doing it. Then I had to, you know, pivot. And then I started talking about mental health. Because what kept me in the game was listening to men's stories.
Yes.
And so that's all we started promoting online was this is the shop where if you want to have those conversations, if you need mental health help or the right therapist, like we can, you know, direct you in the right way, this is the barbershop you want to come to. And so they work for us, you know. And women were like, you know, writing to us online, like my husband needs to come see you guys and to talk. My partner needs to come see you.
Awesome.
So in a way it was just the way that we promoted ourselves. And for me, integrity is a massive part of my business too. Like what you see online, what you see on social media is who I am behind closed doors too. You know, I'm not trying to put on a facade, you know, especially if you're talking about mental health, like this is who I am.
Yeah. Cool.
I'm here doing the work. It's freaking hard.
Yeah.
Putting myself out there, but yeah. It's what connects us all, I think.
Yeah, totally. Are there any kind of legal things that you need to be aware of, like if you're going in partnership with someone else? Because I've seen a few barbers who kind of owe together.
I think if you're going to go into partnership with someone else, I think know who you're going to to work with, who you're jumping into bed with, you know, who you're sharing your whare with, your house, because it can get ugly. You know, I've seen partnerships turn real ugly. And so for me, I mean, my partner's always been my wife. The only arguments we've ever had in business was creative differences.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is a very creative genius. I've got my own creative ideas.
Yeah, cool.
But I think legal stuff, like just know what you're doing in barbering, like hygiene is a massive thing, you know? And I think because we're in the service industry, like serve people like you would like to be served, you know? One thing when I walk into barbershops and I see just people reusing blades or the client sitting there with hair all over his face, like this is service. Like you want them to have a good experience, you know.
Yeah, totally.
This guy is spending $40 to $50 to $60 of his hard earned money. Yep. You want that to be the best service possible.
You talking a bit about price, you know, and giving them a great service. How hard was it to say yes or no to the Kazis or the
Usos? Oh, mate.
Hey, can you hook me up with a cheap haircut? Like,
it was
happen early? Or?
Yes, like even like, so when my wife came on board, when Sarah came on board, we were just friends.
Yeah.
She said, your prices need to go up. You know, you're charging $10 a haircut when she came on board. So $20, to jump from $10 to $20 was so like daunting to me. But I did, you know, I had to learn to know my worth, you know, because as much as you want to serve the community and you want to give, You know, these guys, when I was, you know, some of the men that were sitting in my chair, like, you guys are spending so much money on alcohol. You guys are buying clothes, you know, 10 pairs of shoes. You don't need 10 pairs of shoes. You know, all these things, like, well, $10 more for your haircut to make you look good, like, it's not going to hurt you. So I had to learn my worth, I think, in that aspect. But then also, I've also learned that, you know, money is not the root to all evil, as much as people think. To me, I've had to learn money gives me more options. Money was a tool to do more shit. Yeah, like, I could do more things. I could help more people. And so I would start charging my, you know, friends, and clients became friends, you know. We built this relationship. So I'm like, guys, this is what I want to do. You know, if you pay for the $20 haircut, I can do more stuff. Like, my charity time, I can go out and cut the homeless. I can give my time to men in prison because you guys are supporting it. And so when I spoke from that human experience, like, the men bought in. Like, of course, we all, you know, I will pay. Yeah, sweet, tight ass.
Nice.
But yeah, $20, yeah, ended up going up to 50, 70 bucks for a haircut. And then even then, I was like, man, I've come a long way.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
awesome. Thank you. So,
you've trained, worked with a lot of guys who are now barbers.
Yes.
How proud are you of those guys? Like,
I'm so proud. Like, even this morning, I was looking on my social media, just watching some of the barbers who own shops now. Mm-hmm. I just feel like a proud papa, you know, seeing all my kids around Aotearoa, just doing cool stuff. Like, barbers I've worked with are now holding group therapy, sessions in their barber shops. You know, South Auckland, shout out to my also Fitz 275, who's come to some of our barber wānanga, Louis, that we've ran around the country. Like, he's doing amazing things. Like, he's really shifted culture in Māngere, stemmed from his barber shop. You know, he's created now this Māngere 275 day, the 27th of the 5th of May. He's holds this massive community event for his community, but his business started from a barbershop. You know, so he's just, yeah, he's doing amazing things. So I feel super proud watching all my barbers who have worked under me just do amazing things, become homeowners, become business owners. Like, that's because, you know, at the heart of what we do, when we're talking about family violence, mental health, like, poverty is one of the biggest driving factors for, you know, poor mental health, for family violence. And so we need to, it's educating. My whole purpose and goal, my wife and I, was to really educate our people around finances, you know, to be faithful with what you've been given, with what's in front of you. But then also hope and inspire dreams, you know, for our people. I can't dream more for you than you can't dream for yourself, you know. So, yeah,
because financial stress is massive in families, right? It's just this thing that sits in the background. You don't know what it is, but it's just this pressure.
Yeah.
And, you know, the stats are out there, you know, family or marriage, you know, breakdowns are caused by financial stress. So, man, it's awesome what you guys are doing.
Thank you. So,
awesome.
I mean, I still remember this, some of the fights. I remember mum and dad was all over financing.
That's right.
And coercive control was a massive thing as well. You know, dad had all the finances, mum had nothing. But mum was the one that was, you know, at home cleaning the house, putting food on the table, cooking dinner, yet she didn't have access to any money. So growing up, I witnessed this. And even when we got our barbershop, I think our community, my community, Pasifika community, think, oh, you've made it, you're rich.
Yeah.
So, nah, I've got overheads to pay, I've got staff to feed. Like, there's so many elements to running a business. You know, my mum would always come in every week and say, son, you got any money for us? Like, mum, I don't have money right now. I'm trying to make money so I can help you. But currently, you know, your son's just trying to make ends meet, you know, got to feed my staff.
What do you say to those, you know, bus speaker out there who have, you know, that, you know, there's that voice that comes, or that phone call that comes from mum or dad? They go, hey, son, you're so good, you do you have a little bit of money to spare? What would you say? Like, how brave do you need to be to say no? Or
you got to be brave.
What does it take to say no?
Yep.
To you know, talk in your book, you talk a bit about boundaries. Can you explain how you went about it?
Yeah, like I have a friend, a counselor friend, who was counseling this young Samoan man. This is a cool story. And you know, he wanted to get ahead. He was at uni studying law, but then a whālavelave, a family buried and happened. A family member passed away. And when we say family member, we're talking about a distant cousin passed away. His dad approached him and said, son, we need money to help support the family over in Samoa, the funeral that's happening, whālā bilawi, etc. And the son said, well, dad, I'm at uni. I don't have any money. And his dad then forced him to leave uni and go get a job. And so he did. He tried to hustle both, but he said, I can't. And so my counselor gave him advice and said, if you can refrain, like, what do you want to do? He said, I want to be a lawyer. He said, well, if you can say, if you can learn to say no to your parents, that this is your dream in life, blah, blah, blah. And so he did. And the pushback he got cancelled from his parents. Like, his parents didn't want to know him, disowned him, kicked him out. And, you know, he was so, so down. But he stuck at it. He got his law. He got his degree. Became a lawyer. Ended up working for a massive firm in Australia. And then when he got his first paycheck, he knocked on mum and dad's door and he said, "Yeah." And his mum and dad just cried, like, you know, saying no to, you know, his parents 5 years ago was hard. Was the hardest season of his life. But now his parents understood. You know, the bigger picture, like, my son's in a better place now, and he's bought them a house, all these things. Like, he would never be able to do that if he had said no. And so I think saying no is courageous, is hard, it's scary as fudge, but it's so important to stick to your goals or what you want to achieve. It's not selfish, I think. And I think a lot of our people, because we're nurtured and groomed to serve at the cost of ourselves, I think... In a way, you have to serve yourself in order to serve the rest of our community. You know, and I look at myself. If I never did the work myself to heal, to have these hard conversations with myself, with my family, I would not be in a position to do the work I do today without our communities now. You know, I can and go into any gang pad and have hard conversations with men and challenge their thinking on gang culture, challenge their thinking on how they treat their wives, because I've done the work myself. And when you're working with people, with especially with men, they're gonna don't know if you're a fake.
That's right.
You know, if you're a bad or not a bad. Yeah, you can see for it. And so it has to come from a real place. And so I always encourage people, do it with, you know, obviously humility and integrity. You know, don't just, because our parents are only doing what they know. They're only speaking from a place, their lens, their experience. And so us who are now more educated, and I would always say this to mom, like, mom, you came to New Zealand for a better life. We have grown up here. We're educated. Like, we... You have to trust that your sacrifice is in good hands. You know, you sacrifice the motherland to come to New Zealand for a better life. We are the result of that. Like, I'm educated now. I know better, so I can do better.
So true.
And so mum, she got there eventually. Yeah. But at first, she was like, oh, Lee, this kid does not listen, disrespectful. But
yeah, it's painful.
Yeah, it was. But she was super proud too. Like, man, my son's got a barbershop. My son owns houses. Like, you know. But
it's that long-term vision, right? That's the struggle, because coming from the islands is the day-to-day kind of sustenance. Not used to saving food because, well, it's so warm and humid, it goes off.
Hard out.
And it's those behaviours that doesn't quite translate here. And why did you close the shop? So that was only last year, wasn't it?
Yes, we closed last year, April. So we signed a 4+4+4 lease. So we had done 8 years.
Cool.
And so landlord wanted us to do the next four. But because I had worked, you know, inundated, I'm getting caught up all around the world now to go and speak. So I was hardly at the shop and I couldn't juggle both, you know. And so I wanted to be faithful with these new opportunities, what was in front of me. And I never see myself barbering forever. You know, barbering has only been a vehicle to have these talanoa, have these conversations with our people. It was a hard call. I had been sitting on it for about a year before we decided. We decided to close. It's been probably one of the best decisions I've made.
Wow.
Because I loved it. Even my son was like, Dad, I want the barbershop. I'm like, son. Like, we'll open up a barbershop, you know, later on down the line, you know. It's not be or end all to this barbering gig. We close in. So, yeah, been traveling, doing this mahi, doing this work.
Wicked. Cool. Let's talk about the book, She Is Not Your Rehab. It's confronting, challenging, but the, some of the stories of people who have reached out and kind of transformation are super, like, beautiful and empowering, inspiring. What gave you the idea, really, to write a
what? Well, my wife is the writer. It was hard. It was especially hard to put your story. You know, you're putting your most precious taonga, the measina of your story, on piece of paper for the world to now critique. True. That was freaking scary. You know, freaking scary. And even
it's a piece of you.
It's your family. Yeah. This is your family story. So I had to ask mom's permission. First, because it was really her story. You know, as much as it's my story, it's her story of witnessing my mom be a rehab center. And so my mom, very typical Samoan woman, very private, said, "Son, why do you always want to tell the sad stories? You know, tell the happy stories." And I would always respond to mom, "Which one's mom? Which ones?" And she would just sit there in silent. When she read the manual script, the first manual script, she cried and she said, "Son, tell our story well." Because I said, "Mom, our story's not unique. You know, what's unique is a brown man standing up and talking about it, but our story is not unique. It's the story of many of our children who are in state care, who are still struggling behind closed doors."
True.
And the reason why we wanted to write the book was because I was the kid. Every time my dad did a long leg in prison for domestic violence, for beating up mom, for doing something silly, we were the kids at home wishing and hoping, man, when dad gets out, hopefully he's changed. Hopefully someone inside has helped him because he's sober. This is the perfect time to help him. Unfortunately, that day never came.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, after the TED Talk, we had Indigenous people from all around the world, from Canada, from Hawaii, from America, from the UK, reaching out, writing to us like, "We resonate with your story. Like, how can we have access to your tools, to your insights?" And so what we were writing, we decided to write a book, and Penguin approached us. Penguin approached us during the mosque shooting that happened here in Christchurch. Yep. We started helping out our Muslim whānau, and Penguin came and offered, you know, they offered thousands of dollars of books and vouchers. And then they asked us, "Oh, are you guys doing anything?" And we were already writing our book.
Wow.
And so this is what we pushed it to Penguin, and they said, "Cool." And I said, "But my goal is to get this book into every prison in Aotearoa.
Yeah.
I want every person incarcerated to have this book because everyone's sober while they're inside." Penguin's response was, "Well, our goal is to sell books."
Yes. Yeah.
I'm like, "Okay, well," and then they asked us, you know, how many people incarcerated.
Yeah.
We said 9,300. At the time, there was 9,350. And so Penguin said, "It's going to cost you guys about $100,000. That's buying it at, you know, cost price." And so we did. Wifey went to work, did her magic, and reached out to a couple of organizations, and different organizations funded it. And so we raised $100,000. In 2021, every person incarcerated in New Zealand received the book.
Wow.
And so that was to say I'm super proud is an understatement.
Yeah.
Like you said, the messages we've received from men in prison who finally understand the correlation of their childhood trauma and their behavior, you know, the light bulb turned on for them, to receive letters from partners outside, to receive letters from children.
Mm.
You know, this is the first time dad's ever apologized to us, sorry for the chaos he created, you know. It's been humbling. It's been so worth it. And so, it's just the books now. It's in Hawaii prisons. It's in the Cook Island prisons. It's now being distributed for Australia.
Yep.
My whole goal is to really create a generation that breaks cycles, a cycle breaker generation.
And that's amazing.
Sorry, it was an intense.
Fire up. There's so many ways you can go from here, but I'm kind of going to go to dealing with a publisher, right? How does it work contractually, financially with them?
Right. Financially, look, if you want to be if you want to make money in this country as a writer, don't get into writing. Like, you're not going to make heaps of money. But for us, was to build our profile, was to build the kaupapa, was to spread the kaupapa more. And so from this book, more opportunities have come, different organizations from all around the world, governments from all around the world have reached out, like, "We need this.
Wow.
We need your work here in our country." And so we've done a lot of work over in the UK. We're still doing a lot of work over in the UK because no one knows how to work with men.
Yeah.
Especially those who have perpetrated violence, you know. And so I come from a lens and a perspective that all our research has come from the ground up. It's come from barbershops here in Aotearoa, yes. And we've talked to men over the last 15 years. And
it's not a survey.
No, it's not. No. This is from real conversations, having these conversations and asking these men hard questions. And all the men have said the same things, like, simplify it. We don't want psychobabble. Really? Like, speak to our hearts, don't speak to us up here.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, all our work has come from this research and just humanizing men. Oh, you know, when I sit with men in prison, I can tell you honestly, over 90% of the men who are incarcerated in this country and in other countries were once upon a time a victim themselves, you know? And so if we continue to, you know, cancel men or you know, throw them in prison and throw away the key, it's like, we're not doing, that's not healing them, because these men will come out, they are still someone's superhero. They are still the children, you know, children still look to them as dads, as my dad, that's all they've ever known. And so if we don't help them heal, the cycle will just carry on, you know?
It's like you kind of said before, you know, you were waiting for your dad to be a better man or different man. Yeah. But nothing
ever clicked. Yeah. Nothing ever clung, you know, for him to change. And so that's where we speak from. I speak from a lived experience lens of, these are my brothers, these are my uncles. Like, we need to help them heal so they stop transmitting that onto your partners.
Yeah. Fire out. Your book is, like, you know, you dedicate the book to your mum.
Yeah.
What does she mean to you?
Oh. I do the work I do today because of mum. I know she's super proud, you know, but I want her to also know that her pain, the olanga that she lived is not a waste, you know, it's not wasted on me anyway. And I know that, you know, especially Pasifika men, like, we're such mummy's boys, you know, we love our mum. Mum can do no wrong, even though mum's annoying and she tries to get herself involved in our relationships.
Yeah.
It's still, you know, mum was the first woman that I ever loved, you know, I ever fell in love with. And so, she means everything. She is on her shoulders is where I do this work, you know, on my mum's shoulders. Every sacrifice, me and my brothers have the saying, mum rolled out the red carpet for us, you know, the blood that she shed for us, it's not in vain. And so,
That's beautiful.
Thank you also.
In the book, you touch on the five love languages: words of affirmation, acts of service, receiving gifts, quality time, and physical touch. Why is it important that people are aware of those ways of loving or being loved when navigating relationships?
Yeah, I think we all have different love languages. And I think if you don't learn your partner's and your children's love languages, you can totally miss the boat. You can totally miss, you know, I know of a friend who married this woman and, you know, he was out in the garden and he's like, man, I've married this woman that does nothing. And he would come in after doing the garden and there'd be like letters all around the house. And so her love language was obviously words of affirmation and his love language was service. And so they just totally didn't connect, you know. And so he thought, this woman doesn't love me, but she does love you. She's just saying it in her love language in that way. Yes. And she wants you to know through words. And so when they started speaking each other's love languages, he started giving her words. She realized, oh, my husband's love language is service. Okay, I better, you know, help him do stuff around the house. And it was beautiful, you know. And it's the same with my wife. Like, my wife, her love language is words. And so you often, if you follow me on social media, I will talk about my wife openly, much to a lot of my clients, you know. It's like, bro, giving us a bad light here, you know. But I would, that's my wife's love language. Yeah. She doesn't need a ring or, you know, new clothes or new shoes. She loves words.
Yeah.
My love language is service. So I love coming home to a hot meal.
Yeah, working.
You know, like food straight to the soul. So my wife, she serves me in every way in that aspect, you know.
No. It's funny you said that story. I thought you were talking about me and my wife. Because she, in our early part of our marriage, she was out in the garden.
And I was really?
Yeah. She, I don't know if she loved it. I thought she did.
Yeah.
But she's like, why is Willie not coming out to help me?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm in here looking up, you know, looking after the kids. I'm like, that's how you love, not how I love.
Yeah.
So, sorry. I was like, talking about this friend, you know, that's Willie?
Yeah. Nah, so important to learn each other's love language, especially our kids. I find with our kids, you know, they speak all the love languages, and then as they get older, one or two usually start, you know, standing out than the rest. So,
cool. And when you add up all the violence and abuse that you experience, like, logically, that equation shouldn't equal happiness, right?
No.
How have you turned that extreme pain, suffering into a successful life and beautiful whānau?
The most courageous thing I believe any person can do is to own their story fully. Mm-hmm. I've owned my story fully. I've owned the good, the bad, the ugly, as painful as it is. You know, doing this work, seeing a therapist is not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, as humans, we're so vulnerability adverse, we're so risk adverse, we don't want to lean into the discomfort. But that's where I believe life really begins, is in our discomfort.
Yeah. Well,
And so I'm just so used to living uncomfortable, you know, when you hear another headline or read another headline of another kid being abused or murdered or raped, like, it's just, I just have to take a deep breath, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I read them to keep my heart, you know, on the street, on the pulse. But I do that because it's important and needed, you know? It's so important to do this work internally as much as externally, but it's so important to do it internally within your house, because how else are people, like, when I work with men, they get it when I model to them what a healthy masculine man looks like. Mm-hmm. They get it when I model to them what a healthy relationship looks like. When me and my wife do this activity, we sit in a circle, we get the men to stand around in a circle, and we sit in a circle and we just ask each other vulnerable questions, and we have, you know, honest conversations. Yeah. These men have never ever witnessed it. Like, oh, that's what vulnerable, but that's what intimacy looks like. So yes, it's when you allow the other person to really see you, who you are. Because you're only loved as much as you are known. You know, the question is, will we have the courage to be known? We don't want to be known. Yes. We want to be known as a tough guy, as the provider. But like, the other part of us that we don't like people to know is that we are soft. Yeah. We are sensitive, you know. Like, I can be hard.
We do get hurt.
Yeah, we do get hurt. Like, you know, and this is why I always talk to guys who are in gangs. Like, it's easy to go and, I mean, not for me, but, you know, you guys are so stuck in the cycle of, you know, violence or abuse or even robbing or crime. Like, what's hard now, what's gangster now, is to be vulnerable, is to show up for our kids, is to not hurt our partners. Man. Like, that's gangster.
Yeah.
And so when they hear that and they see their model, like, oh, okay, that's a different kind of masculinity to what they've learned.
It's the opposite, eh?
It's the opposite. It's more rewarding and life-giving and purposeful.
Yeah, crazy. Let's talk about personal finance. What do you think a speaker and a lot of Māori are not very good at talking about money?
Oh, such a taboo topic. I think just, I mean, I grew up in church, and so, you know, it was we never talked about finances. Yeah. You know, if anything, you just gave what's mine is yours, you know. And there's a beauty in that, and the tribal culture where, you know, what's mine, I share.
Yep,
you know, what's my, you know, my house is your house, all those things. But then it's like, we never get ahead because we're always giving, giving, giving. Because you can still serve and not give, you know. And I think,
because giving is not necessarily equated to money.
No.
Other things.
Yes, so. Yes. And so for me, I'm very intentional with where I invest. You know, my energy and time is key. But I think we need to normalize the kōrero around finances and money, because it affects all of us.
Yeah.
You know, like, deluding ourselves and ignoring that money doesn't affect all of us. Like, we're not in a better position if you don't talk about it.
Mm.
So it's important to talk about it. My wife was very instrumental in that conversation with me, because I hated talking about it. I didn't know how to talk about it. You know, my parents never talked about it. You know, if my mum ever talked about it with my dad, it would be a hiding. You know, well, how come there's no money for groceries? Or how come all your money's going on alcohol? Like, what about the kids' school shoes and school uniforms? Like, we just never talked about it, you know. And if you did talk about it, anger would be the end result.
Yeah, so that's why you didn't talk about it. Because anger, you knew what was coming.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the only time I ever heard about money was at church. Give, 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 give. So it's like, It's like, Mama, I've got a camp coming up. Can I go to camp? You know, it's going to cost $60. Like, no, we don't have the money. But I think it's important to talk about, because it's in our society. You know, we all need it.
Yeah.
But I think we need to move past that money is evil. I think money is, like I said before, it's a tool.
Yeah.
If we change our perspective or our view of money, like, you'll start to see our people flourish more.
Yeah, cool. Do you consider yourself good with money now?
I think so. Much better than I used to be. I mean, when I first got my paycheck, me, I was the guy, like, I'm going to buy my these Jordans I could never afford. Yeah, exactly. My wife's like, you don't need 5 Jordans. I'm like, oh. You know, so I've learned, you know, learned. Yeah, I mean, when I first had my first son, you know, I wanted them to have the same Jordans I had, you know. Cool. Those ones living through your children. Well, I never had it, so I want to give it to him. But you learn as you go, you know, like, okay, being grateful for what I have, you know, especially in the climate that we're living today, seeing kids around the world who are, you know, are living in bombed nations. You know, I count myself very, very great, you know, blessed to be here in Aotearoa. My kids have a roof over our heads. There, we even have rice, you know. And so gratitude is the attitude. But I will consider myself 100% better with money today. I wasn't at first, though, because I never knew how to use it. How can you be good at something that you've never had?
Yes.
So when you do get it, it's like, oh, I'm gonna splash out and, you know, buy all this.
See what this is all
exactly
about.
Next minute.
Are you naturally a spender or a saver?
Spender, 100% spender. Not just on myself, but I'll spend on other people. Like, I love to go out for lunch with friends and just, you know, shout them, buy them. Like, because to me, I've never looked at money as an identity of myself. You know, like, it's just, it comes and goes. Like, I know I can make it, but what I've learned is to be faithful with what's in front of me, with the little that I've had, with what the much I've been given. Be faithful there, because, you know, so many people go without that. I knew what it was like going without money. So I'm not saying it's my be or ends or, you know, but it's being faithful with what I have, and using it to better our people, our community.
Yeah. Who manages the money in your household?
Not me. No, my wife. My wife is amazing with money. Cool. Like, she is such a good saver. She just knows where everything is. And often she's like, you don't know where any of the money goes. Like, no, I'm just not good with this stuff. Like,
do you guys talk about it?
We talk about it.
Or do you have scheduled times, or is it just off the cuff?
I mean, we talked about it last night. Wifey looked at the credit card. I was like, what's with this $5 spending money here at the gym? I was like, oh, it's me buying myself a protein shake. That's a meal. And she's like, do you need that? Like, so we're always talking about money.
Cool.
And she's always keeping me in check. And then also me's like, oh, do you really have to upgrade the house? Like, you know, all those things. Yes. But yeah, we have open corridor about it. We have a shared account. She has access to my bank account. I have access to her. So we see, you know, we're accountable to one another. And that's the partnership that we've decided our relationship, our marriage should be. It should always be one of integrity. Everything, nothing is ever off the table.
Cool.
You know? Everything is allowed to be talked about.
And how do you guys make those money decisions?
Together. We talk about it together. So if we want anything changed in the house, wifey will always, you know, talk to me about it. She's okay. You know, she's the care of the house, makes everything look nice.
Yeah.
And she'd always check in with me. You know, babe, should we put a new fence in over here? I'm like, yep, sweet. Do we need it? She's like, yep. Okay.
Sweet. Are you guys investors?
Yes.
Yep.
So we're into property.
Cool.
Try dabble a little bit online with like NFTs and all that, but still can't get my head around. I don't have enough time to educate myself in that arena, but we do have property investments.
Yeah. Why property?
I think just like it's a guaranteed investment. You know, property's never going to go out. Land is always, you know, it's a hard thing these days. You know, it's limited.
Yes.
But I think, money, land, property is always making money.
Yeah,
if you can hold on to it.
Yes.
And
who do you get financial advice from?
Just different people in our life. Like my wife's dad, he was a very successful business owner. Property right throughout Tamaki. He owns commercial and, you know, houses right throughout New Zealand, really. He used to run, he helped set up Seville's. So Seville's academy was a New Zealand's number one heat dressing academy. So my father-in-law was the man behind it. I really got a lot of my barber business advice from him.
Okay.
We've had a lot of good people in our corner help us.
What would you say to someone who's kind of struggling with money and finding it difficult just to...
There is people out there who want to help. You know, as much as... If you can get past the initial stage of thinking that it's shameful, you know, asking for help, like, I guarantee you it will be the best thing that you can do. So reach out and ask for help. There's a lot of financial advisors out there. you know, yourself, if you people want to get into property, you know, you're the man to talk to. But yeah, I think asking for help, like, what's the alternative? You not asking for help and you getting into worse debt, yep. You just, you know, shooting your best shot, blind leading the blind, or you asking people who have done a better job, you know? Yep. It's the same for me, thing for me or for my mental health or, you know, therapy counselors. Like, I'm not going to ask a brother who is struggling for advice on how to overcome what I'm struggling with. I'm going to go see a therapist, a counselor. If I want to be, you know, get healthy and nutrition, eat, you know, healthy, like, I'm going to go ask a nutritionist what to eat. You know, I'm not just going to discover that myself, you know, like body, blood, all these things that you have to do tests on.
Yeah, mate. You closed the barbershop. How do you make a living now? What keeps the money coming in now?
So I do a lot of speaking gigs. We've started a mental health app called Inner Boy. So a lot of the stuff we try and we create, like, you know, we got the books into prison for free. Mm. Now we've created a mental health app, which is free. Yeah, a lot of my business friends are like, do you guys make any money off your things? But we do, obviously, but my goal is to really make it accessible. Like, we want healing accessible for our people, especially for our people, you know, who are struggling, you know, to make ends meet with, you know, groceries, keeping the lights on. And so, I make a lot of my income today is through speaking, through advising people, our mental health app. We're funded by MSD to run that. But that just keeps, you know, that afloat. The back end, like, tech is so expensive to keep tech up and going. So that's always ongoing. We've only done stage one of our app.
Okay.
We're going to do stage two, but that's currently geo-locked to New Zealand. So it's just awesome. When we released that app, you know, thousands of men jumped online and started using it, you know. And so it's been amazing. But I travel a lot now. We do frontline training with police, corrections, social workers all around the world. So that's my main income stream now.
If we look at the app, how tricky was that to build, and how long was that in planning before you launched?
That was 2.5 years in the making. You know, we had to get the right tech team on board, like, you know, stuff I don't even understand, you know. So we created all the content, or the, you know, the video work, the artwork, you know. So it's a family crap proper, but the tech side of it, you know, the back end stuff that I have no idea how to, you know, the language of tech,
coding,
all that stuff. Like, we had to get a proper tech team, and the government, you know, they help with that. They have a government.
Awesome.
They were awesome on that. It's been awesome. Like, Inner Boy, that was birth. So it's called innerboy.nz.
Yep.
It's free for Aotearoa currently.
Awesome.
I think it will be free
just
forever.
On the App Store?
Like, no, so it's not on the App Store. So that's stage two. We're trying to get it into the App Store.
I see.
So you have to go into your web browser and type in innerboy.nz.
Cool.
That was actually birthed during lockdown.
Yeah.
When we went into COVID lockdown here in New Zealand, I jumped on national television, did an interview with Dr. Ange Jury, who was the Women's Refuge CEO.
Oh.
Prime time television at 6 o'clock news. I said on national television, if there's any brother out there struggling with violence, his mental health or anger, please reach out to me. I promise I'll respond. Next minute, thousands of people started messaging me. So that 6 week, our first lockdown for 6 weeks, I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning, every night, writing to men, because I wanted every response to be unique, you know, an individual for, you know, the men that were writing. But what really broke my heart was receiving a message from a young kid, from kids, but one kid in particular who was 12 years old, who said, "Matt, I seen your national television last night. You see that you help men who struggle with anger. Can you please help me help my dad who's abusing my little brother?"
Wow.
When I read that message, my heart broke, because it's not our children's responsibility to regulate our emotions.
Mm.
So I jumped online, wifey and I jumped online, and I said, there is nothing online. Everything online was imported from somewhere, decorated with a kōru pattern, cost money, outdated, just didn't resonate with our people. And so we decided, let's create something. So Inner Boy was birthed. Inner Boy is the concept of reparenting ourselves, the inner child. Again, like I said before, when you sit with people who have perpetrated violence, you'll realize and recognize that they too were once upon a time a victim themselves.
Yes.
So until we heal their inner child, we will start to see, you know, our domestic violence stats, our mental health stats really, you know, drop. But it's connecting with that. And, awesome. And that's come from me, from barbering. Men who were sitting in my chair when I would connect with the inner child. You know, these men, grown men, men in business suits, men in game patches, sitting there crying, you know, because they felt seen.
Yeah.
They felt seen. They felt heard.
Yeah. Wow.
How many downloads or how many people has it reached?
I currently don't know, but these are the uptake. These are about over 50,000.
Sheesh.
So it's the first day we dropped, there was over 30,000 people on the app. So it's, yeah, it's blowing our mind, you know. Again, when people think men don't want to do the work, they do want to do the work. Yeah. They do want to be good fathers. They do want to be good husbands. It's just making it accessible for them, what resonates with our men. And again, it's all come from our research, from talking to men over the last 15 years.
Ah, man, that's awesome.
How does it feel and what does it mean to your Ainga for you to be nominated for New Zealand Derby Awards and to become a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit? That's an epic.
Thank you. So proud. My family's very proud.
Yeah.
Again, being Samoan and talking about what I talk about is very taboo. You know, it's unheard of in our community. If anything, a lot of our people still think it's shame.
Yeah.
But my family, which is all that matters to me, are super proud. You know, I had my brother, my older brother, who has experienced, you know, horrific domestic violence. Family violence from our father and other people, sit at the table with me at New Zealand of the Year and just, you know, he teared up and cried. And this was the brother that was hard. Like, he is the hard gangster brother who was just like, I'm so proud of you. Mum will be proud of you. My family's super supportive.
That's cool.
And it's, you know, at first everyone thought the book was about shaming our family, but when people actually read it, it's the opposite. There's a lot of empathy and compassion for our community, for my family. You know, it's humanizing why people perpetrate violence. It's not a shame. Yeah, and if we don't talk about it.
Rationale is to, hey, this is why. Yes. It's a lot about the why.
Yeah. Because, you know, the boogeyman's real and the boogeyman only exists in the dark. Yeah, and so if we put light on it, like, there is no space for him.
Far out. And you've written a book, creating that, started a business city. Out of all the work you've done, what are you most proud of?
I am most proud out of all the work that I've done. When I walk through my door, my kids run up to me and hug. They all fight over who's going to get the first hug with dad. And I'm super proud of that because I don't ever recall having that for my dad. I don't ever, if anything, we were the opposite. We were, dad's home. Let's stay quiet, you know. And so to have my kids, dad, you know, like it's always healing. That's why I say healing is not a destination. It's a journey. Like, it's still healing. That's what I'm super proud of. Man. It means Jack or if the world or if our community think, oh, Matt's this cool, you know, mental health guy. If my kids think, check all, if my wife thinks, you know, ill of me. So that's what I'm super proud of. That what you see on socials and public is what I am behind closed doors.
Man.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, thank you.
Man.
What's next? What's next for you guys? You know, you've got heaps on
the plate. There's so much on, much on.
What's next for you
exciting,
guys?
Though.
We're
traveling a lot, like so many different governments are approaching us to help them with their strategies and family violence prevention around the world. But my goal is to really make this conversation of family violence, we want to normalize it.
Yeah.
So how we normalize it is infiltrate pop culture. And so we're working on a documentary at the moment. We've got a super amazing team who are working on it. And this is to explore the origins of family violence. It's educating people. Violence was never our culture. Domestic violence I'm talking about. You know, violence has always been in culture. You know, people have always fought for land. Tribes, iwis have fought each other. But when it comes to violence towards our women, this was never our culture. You know, and the missionaries who came to Aotearoa read this. You know, men were nurturers. Men were gardeners. Yeah. Men protected their children. Men would carry their children wherever they went. We weren't just hunters and gatherers, you know. We were also nurturers. And even in Samoa, that was the way.
Yes.
You know, we have a covenant in Samoa and Tonga. We had a covenant called the Whianganga. A lot of people still practice this. You know, if you were gifted, blessed with a daughter, you were considered sacred because women would carry, you know, our legacy. They would carry on, you know, our name.
Yes.
And so women were never daughters were never allowed in the same room as their brothers, you know. They had to sleep separately. Men were not even allowed in the same room as their sisters, and wherever the sister went to in the village, the brothers had to follow her to protect her. And so it was never our culture. Our people don't know that. You know, people see once we're warriors, people watch the haka, the All Blacks, thinking that violence is our culture. Yeah. It was never our culture, violence towards our woman. And so that's one of our projects we're doing. Wow. My wife is actually writing second book. That's not really public information, so this is the first time I've told publicly and on a platform like this. She's writing the second book to taking on to our first book. Yeah. It's called I Am Not Your Rehab. And so it's a love letter to our, she's thought hard about who she's writing to, and she wants to write this to our daughter's generation.
Yeah.
You know, educating our woman to not be his rehab center. You can be his cheerleader. You can be his safe place. You can be, you know, all these good things, but you are not his rehab center. Mm. You know, you can't do more for him than he's not willing to do for himself. You know, you can support him and cheer him on, which my wife has done for me, but yeah. That's one of the things.
Awesome.
But yeah, there's so many going. Thank you, Saul.
My final question: what does wealth look like to you?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, yeah, wealth's different for everyone, eh? But wealth, true wealth to me, is being at peace with yourself. I'm at peace with myself. True wealth to me is the company that I keep. You know, I'm super proud. I am so blessed to have beautiful people around me, the village I have around me. Yeah. I'm so blessed to have a marriage that I like. You know, I'm married to a woman that I like, not just love, but I like her. Yeah. Like, I actually like and admire my wife. I love my children. I adore my children. I love my family. That already is wealth. You know, add on the extra things like, you know, investment, property, all these things, you know, that's just a reflection of, I believe, my inside world, you know, all these other things that have come. Sure. And so, I think I'm the wealthiest man. Like, I am the wealthiest man, I believe, with what I have.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for coming on. It's been epic hearing your story.
Thank you also. Sorry if I just keep blabbering.
No, it's been great. And I just want to wish you, Sarah, and your kids all the very best for the future. You
thank
know,
you also.
Blessings to you all. Faf day te le lau.
Faf day lau also. Thank you. Thank you, baby.